Welcome to Occupied Territory America with Mike Fader. Today we have a guest on who's edited an extremely interesting book, a book that addresses just about every subject that this show was created to address. That's David Bollier, and he'll be on in just a minute or two. I just want to remind you, if you're a new listener, we have a companion Facebook page to this show. Every issue that's brought up here and other issues as well, political, cultural, economic, are on the Occupied Territory Facebook page. Occupied Territory Facebook page. So check in there if you can. If you don't like Facebook, and who does, or if you're dropped or you've dropped out of Facebook, I'm going to be setting up a new blog site, which I will give you the name of next week. And I'm just going to be posting the same articles on both places. So those of you who aren't connected to Facebook can check in at this blog site. I guess that's about all for right now as far as business goes. David Bollier, I interviewed on Sirius XM a few weeks ago, and he's edited a book along with Silke Helfrich, who is his co-editor, called The Wealth of the Commons, A World Beyond Market and State. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. I don't think much has changed in the last few weeks. So.
Well, the every day has a new story of corporate enclosures and privatizations of the Commonwealth.
I'm afraid so. I was just talking on this show a few days ago about the sale of the post offices, for instance, just to pick one out of many, right? But let's start off with the name of the book is The Wealth of the Commons, A World Beyond Market and State. So right away, we need a definition of the commons.
Well, in the broadest sense, the commons are those things that we all morally or legally own and share together. Things like the atmosphere and our public parks and the human genome and water. And people don't really think of these things as being owned, but increasingly private companies are asserting ownership rights into them, over them, either by using technologies to appropriate them or using patent law for the genome, for example. So there's all sorts of resources that are inheritance from previous generations that are being privatized and closed and essentially dispossessing us as people who should have access and use of these things.
Now, this couldn't really happen without some implicit or explicit cooperation from people who say they own or have been appointed or elected to own things or to run things, right?
Well, it's what I call, there's a sort of a conspiracy or alliance between people involved in the market making money and government.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it the market-state duopoly because they work from different ends of the picture, but the purpose is the same of enriching people through the market, often at the expense of the public like us, because we tend to be less well-organized and our interests are relatively small relative to those who are making a lot of money off of it. So there is this kind of quiet collaboration between politicians and government on the one hand and market and corporations on the other.
It's less quiet if you're a dictator or if you live in a state that's a military dictatorship. You don't have to be so quiet about it. You just hand it over. Like Putin. But in this country, if you voted for the president of the United States, you may have taken it for granted he's not going to give away public lands.
Well, you know, historically and even legally, government often has a legal duty to act as a public trustee for the rest of us. You know, taking care of the public lands and so forth, they can't simply, in fact, there's something called the public trust doctrine in environmental law that says a legislature can't just give away or sell off beachfront or access to water and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, politicians are an ingenious bunch, and they often find ways to precisely do that and not be conscientious trustees.
Hi there.
So that's our problem, really.
Okay. But we do see this increasing all the time. I mean, let me move down a little bit here. So basically, I don't want people to cast this, and people will tend to do this sometimes, although not my listeners generally, but they cast it one way or the other. It's this kind of duality, not to be too Buddhist about it, but it's either the Democrats versus the Republicans or the socialists versus the capitalists. Are you advocating one particular kind of political system versus another?
Well, I think part of the problem is this false sense of duality, the Republicans versus Democrats, left versus right, liberals mm-hmm. versus conservatives. I think in some ways it's beside the point because neither of them are addressing some of these issues of what the market does to dispossess us. And a number of colleagues of mine who work internationally and domestically on the commons are trying to change the language we use to talk about politics, to bring to the fore a lot of these concerns that the two parties are just ignoring because mm-hmm. it's in their sort of they have a consensus around exploiting the public good, and so they don't welcome other voices in elections who might raise these issues.
People get trapped in all this stuff, too, because there's so much going on and there's so little they can control. That's part of the problem. I heard the other day, and maybe you probably know more about this than I do, but some sociologist or anthropologist was writing about the fact that there was an average number of people, around 150, that makes for a controllable human environment.
Well, that's actually called the Dunbar number after the anthropologist who discovered that human beings, actually in their neocortex and brain capacity, can only have enough familiarity in communications with 150 people to be able to keep track of it. Mm-hmm. And that beyond that, you need to develop different systems of governance to be able to, for example, identify people who are doing bad things to the community.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a governance issue in an anthropological sense.
But to expand that into our country, for instance, there's 320 million people in this country. And
yes.
And there are several layers of government that are necessary or unnecessary, but there they are. For instance, once again, as a person, I mean, if I lived in a small community of 150 people, nobody there is going to be giving, none of us there is going to give away anything that belongs to the rest of us in common without obviously having to deal with the rest of us, and we could control that. But when all you have is your vote, which increasingly means less and less as the two parties become more corporate, you vote for something, all of a sudden there's wars. People are being killed with your money. Land is being given away. Fracking is happening on public land, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it sort of points to actually a structural problem with representative democracy that, a vote every 4 years is enough to provide accountability over these things. Well, we've seen how there's all sorts of other governance possibilities, for example, on the Internet, which are often remarkably effective and more sensitive and fine-grained. And we see this in a lot of local commons as well, where people are organizing to take care of their resources in better ways. And I think that's the kind of innovation we need to look for.
Well, are you talking about an almost an inevitable, if we want to be benevolent and look forward to a good future, a breaking down of higher structures of government into smaller, controllable, understandable levels or structures?
I think that's really part of it, and also giving, not making it all representative, but having direct participation, which is increasingly possible with network platforms,
mm-hmm.
where you see, we've seen, of course, the rise of open source software and Wikipedia and actually scores of different wikis, and open access publishing in academia. There's many other examples of this where you have this bottom-up control over your resources. I think that's the kind of innovation we need to see, especially at the local level. And we have things like the local food movement, mm-hmm. the transition town movement, and many others that are trying to devise these new systems for more accountable, responsive governance.
Yeah, this is sort of, now, this show is called Occupied Territory America, and, you know, it's based on the Occupy movement and
mm-hmm.
the stated goals of. You see what they were met, I mean, they were met with the full force of a corporate military state, and all that's left of them is a kind of a ghost of an idea and a point of view, which was appropriated immediately linguistically and politically by the larger powers, right? But, I mean, that's what we're talking about here is local groups controlling their local neighborhoods. I read an article just recently about a town in Mexico, which is virtually lawless, where the government cooperates with the criminals, that took over their town and threw out the police force. And they provide their own policing, and everything is much safer there now, you know.
Well, it reminds me of the bumper sticker reply, if you don't like government, move to Somalia.
Well, yeah, there's that problem. I mean, you have to have some structure and government and rules or laws. You can't live in anarchy, right?
Yes, yes.
I'm reminded of when you talk about this stuff, or when we talk about the commons, I'm reminded of, unless I'm misled or being a romantic here, about an American Indian point of view about the land, which is that it belongs to no one, and it belongs to everyone.
Right. And I think one of the key things to remember about Native Americans is they had a ethic of sufficiency, as opposed to taking as much as you can to monetize as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
They had a culture that was integrated with the land and therefore respectful of it, whereas ours is kind of a rip and run market society.
Well, that's also part of that duality I was talking about before. It's us versus nature. I mean, if you watch TV, which most people have grown up enough, have sense not to, but I guess I'm not one of them. So I'm watching sports or whatever, and then the commercials come on. And these all these, it's the language, too, which is partially part of this book here. People come up, all this American idea of conquering the West. Or, there's a brand new, for instance, because cultural symbols and concepts are pretty illustrative of what's going on in the culture in general. There's a Cadillac commercial, for instance, which it says, it literally says on there, Cadillac versus the world. You know what I mean? It's all this versus. There's even a versus, there was for a long time, a versus channel on TV. You know? But this is something. So this all brings me to another question, which is it in human nature to compete, to be egoistic, to compete with others and to win over others?
Well, I don't like to get too universalistic. Of course, there's a desire for competition and ego that's at play, but I think we've also seen there are all sorts of governance structures, institutional structures that can bring out the better parts of ourselves. And especially, I think part of the problem is the scale of our institutions have gotten so big that it's easier to be a free rider or an exploiter as opposed to having some real accountability to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so a part of our political challenge these days, I think, is to build new institutions that can assure transparency, accountability, participation, and which maybe in an earlier, younger time in American life was more possible.
Well, but when you say part of our responsibility is to build these things, I mean, where does an average person go to start building? How do you start building this? I mean, you've got a choice of two parties, and then, of course, there are third parties, one of which I voted for in the last election.
Well, I think part of the problem is the way you framed the question there. I don't think our emphasis should necessarily right now be entirely on electoral stuff, important as that is.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's all sorts of, one might say, pre-political and cultural things one can do that are very important. I mean, when the civil rights movement started, it was in church basements. It wasn't in the voting booth. That came later. Same with the women's movement and consumer movement. So in some ways, I think there's a lot of stuff going on right now that hasn't registered in the political, the electoral realm. But as I mentioned, the food movement, which actually has come quite a ways in the past 10 years and now is having a California referendum last election on labeling of GMOs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, in other words, they've come a certain journey to become political in that conventional sense. I think the commons is really about building some of this ethic at a local scale and over time devising the new institutions and the coherence to get political and start to assert pressure, sort of like Occupy, but with greater stability and durability than they were able to manage.
Well, you know, they aside from contending with pepper spray and rubber bullets and batons and the animosity of the universal and aggressive animosity of the authorities and the total contempt and ridicule from most media, aside from all that, they had internal problems. They couldn't have been more communal and cooperative. But, for instance, just on a practical basis, when I try to get in touch with them frequently on this show, when it first began, the whole thing, the occupations, I would either never get a response, even from the committee that was there to handle public relations, let's say.
Uh-huh.
I would never get a response, or they said they were putting my request to appear on the radio to talk to a committee vote.
Uh-huh.
And I never heard back from them. Do you know what I mean? What is the internal responsibility of any localized group or co-op or community? I mean, You see, where does the line get crossed somehow between structural authority and discipline and equal participation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that their laudable desire to be egalitarian and participatory reached such an extreme that they were dysfunctional as an institution. And swarming activity can work in certain public demonstrations or perhaps online, but it maybe is not necessarily a way to implement things over the long term. In other words, you do need certain structures, certain delegations of power, but of course balanced with accountability.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think that was part of the challenges of the network-based Occupy movement, to find new structures so they could evolve into a meaningful political force. And they may rediscover that.
Well, there are a lot of places like that, most of which I admire greatly, especially for somebody who tries to find guests or interesting articles about things to talk about. And one of my favorite ones is called Common Dreams. You know Common
mm-hmm.
Dreams?
It's
terrific. And everything is, you know, for free. Everything mm-hmm. is there for anybody to use, to quote. So, I mean, that's, but look what happens when a guy like Aaron Swartz comes along.
Yeah, well, he was working for quite a while in trying to do this. Perhaps he didn't realize he was messing with some pretty serious forces and pushback. Mm-hmm. He hadn't quite encountered that in the past.
But this idea of this being in human nature is something people have to understand or tolerate. But there are some people that go too far. Like, for instance, did you ever see this movie Chinatown, Jack Nicholson?
Oh, of course, yes.
You know, I'm full of cultural references today. But there's an incredible scene in there, which is appropriate to what we're talking about here, is he goes up against, he gets into this private yacht club where the real bad guy is, you know, the one who's trying to own the water supply
mm-hmm.
of all of Los Angeles. And at that time, it was considered almost like fantasy or ridiculous. Now, of course, it's almost a reality. And he confronts the man, and he said, "You're already rich. You have everything. You own everything." He said, "Why do you want to do something like this? I mean, what is it? Why do you need more?" And his answer, I will always remember, he didn't say anything. He gestured off screen, and somebody came and hit the other guy over the head. You see what I'm saying? These are the kinds of people that we're really dealing with in this country and elsewhere.
And, it comes back to how political culture can do that. I think we've outgrown some of the former systems, like, you know, regulation and federal agencies were supposed to be the way of taming the market.
Right.
And I think we've seen over the past 30, 40 years, especially since Ronald Reagan came in and instituted this neoliberal agenda, we've seen that that's really an ineffective way for providing accountability to the market. And I think that's why a lot of environmental groups I know, for example, said, "Yeah, let's keep doing that, but let's just try to hurt their brand reputation, because that's where it's going to hurt them more."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're in a stage of experimentation of how we can control these incredibly concentrated economic forces, which are politically run amok.
Now, the idea of Occupy and my point of view about all this is that voting is, at this moment, close to being almost a waste of time. And the outside, and you mentioned this before, is where we have to go, like the civil rights movement, the anti-war movements, any other movement. If you look back in American history, right, the greatest things that changed, even if some of them were wrong-headed, like, prohibition or whatever, but the greatest changes came from people getting out on the streets, from alternative to the current political or the standard political system. I mean, populism, revolts, revolutions, massive occupations, demonstrations, this is where things changed, right?
And I think they often had a cultural origin in people's everyday lives first, mm-hmm. and then they manifested politically later. And I think that that's why some people trivialize that kind of private citizen action. You know, Occupy could have been another one of those forgettable, you know, look at those kooks in the park.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of movements start that way when unknown everyday people start to take things in their own hands with a new idea and then start to build with it. I think we need to sort of validate and respect that rather than making fun of it.
Before you mention one of the things that's been privatized, the human genes, could you explain that in a little bit more detail? Because when I read about that, I am constantly astonished, though I shouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's actually a famous case pending in the federal courts right now where a Utah company has a patents on what are called breast cancer susceptibility genes, meaning they have patented the knowledge that these particular elements of the genes can be used to make diagnostic tests for breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to exclude other people from developing competitive breast cancer tests. And this has the consequence of preventing scientific researchers from doing research into breast cancer because they might run afoul of the patent.
Well, it seems to me that if somebody was to actually violate this law, do some research, come up with something generic and easy to save people's lives, anybody who dies in between from breast cancer, these people who are preventing people from doing research are almost in the area of being criminals, I think.
Well, that's the whole point of politics, is determining what's criminal and what's not, and what shall be privileged as private property. Mm. And the courts the legislatures, the U.S. Congress, have said you can have private property in genes. And this, of course, is not just about breast cancer. It's about agricultural crops.
Oh, yes. So
and creating clones and tissue, human tissue, mm-hmm. that is replicated. Who should own this stuff? Well, yes, a lot of research is very expensive and requires capital, but does that mean that somebody could then own something that was arguably the heritage of humankind over millennia, as opposed to something they created?
Well, you know, to me, the answer is so obvious that it shouldn't be allowed. But how to get that into the minds of the general public so that their government does not allow companies to do this? I mean, I was reading a list of things the other day of private companies that own the genetic or DNA code to things. One of them was the whole crop of turmeric, a spice, in another country.
You know, there's a number of so-called biopiracy cases where multinational companies have gone to India, Madagascar, right. or places with biodiversity to seize plants and patent them.
Well, so their idea being that if they do the research and they come up with the DNA of an already existing, multi-used by generations or millennia of people, if they actually come up with what is already there, to the DNA explanation of what's already there, they own it.
Right? Well, there's been some pushback, and a lot of people in those countries have started, for example, there's something called the Traditional Knowledge Database, which is trying to document some of the folk customs and knowledge, and thereby make it, in the patent terms, they call it prior art. And if you
Right.
can cite the prior art, it means you can't qualify for a patent. So they're trying to establish all of these folk traditions as prior art, one way to prevent the patenting. But until that's happened, the turmeric was one example. Another famous one was the neem seed, a quite common seed in India, which was attempted to be patented. So there has been the political struggle over this has advanced, and it's not quite an open field the way it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, 20% of the human genome is now privately owned.
It's hard for me to actually conceive of that in my mind, you know, that they, well, anyhow. So
yeah, I mean, let's just say don't underestimate the power of lawyers to create artificial property rights. I mean, there's airspace over Grand Central Station, which is owned, was owned as air rights. You know, so people are buying and selling air, meaning the right to build your building up into those spaces.
Well, you know, once again, you know, another referral. You know, I guess what it is that as I'm getting older, I'm seeing more and more that what appear to be popular fiction or popular cultural expressions, like, you know, big Hollywood movies, are the best predictors years in advance of what's actually happening. What's actually happening now? In other words, they see it, they feel it, just like an artist does sometimes ahead of other people, like the canary in a coal mine. And I'm thinking of a movie like Blade Runner, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Which is, when you walk around a city like that, first of all, there is no daylight anymore because of global warming. It's always, it's even nighttime because of smog or it's raining. And there are buildings that tower, you know, several hundred stories into the sky, half mile, a mile high, more than that, you know? And the skies are filled with light and advertisements because they are owned and rented. They're rented part of the sky. You know, in New York City, for instance, in my own city here, Mayor Bloomberg, who is basically the king of New York, not the mayor of New York, he is actually, nobody could be more pro-business than Mayor Bloomberg. We used to have ads always, and this is common wherever you were, I'm sure, too. On public buses and trains, there's always ads if you look up or on the side of buses for a TV show or a movie or whatever. It used to be Miss Rheingold back in the day, right? Whatever it was. But now these ads are actually, because of technology, they are jumping and moving and they're in 16 different colors and they're in your face right when you get on the subway. On the buses, they used to be on the side. Now you get on a bus and you look out the window, but you can't look out the window now because the ad for the next Alien movie has a claw in your face. It's crawled up the side of the window, you see?
Well, it's almost gotten to the degree of Clockwork Orange where Alex, they propped his eyelids open so he had to watch things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get into an elevator, you have to watch the TV ad, or you go to the gas pump and pump your car and there's an ad that starts blaring in your face.
Well, it's the same way you walk into a bank. There's no, I've been in doctor's offices where you had to watch something. And of course, I'm always going over and turning it off. And I guess that's probably against the law, but the bank, I've confronted, I don't know how many bank managers and doctor's office managers. I'm saying, I walk over, like in a hospital room, I'll walk over and I'll say, I'll turn off the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll get this nasty look from the bank manager. Why did you turn off the TV, sir? You're not allowed to do that. I said, nobody's watching it, and it's making a lot of noise. My feeling, unfortunately, is that most people have become acclimated to this, like frogs in a pot, you see?
Yeah, well, and they might even have contracts with special networks that are producing these ads for, you know, captive target audiences.
That's true. But so it really is up to people. People can't say, oh, well, that's terrible. Somebody should do something about it. Obviously, the somebody is us, right?
Exactly. And I think that we need to start to push back on that and challenge and embarrass them. You know, it's a constant struggle, but it's part of trying to retain a sense of human dignity, too.
And I guess the last question I have here, which is, as obviously most of my questions are as a statement, is that right now at this point, it seems to me that anybody who wants any kind of real change is going to have to probably wind up, and I'm not the only one who says this, I'm a political theorist and other activists in history, if you don't go out and break a few rules, not necessarily really big, nasty ones, but if you don't break a lot of little rules they set up to keep you calm and quiet, then nothing really is going to change.
I think that you need to organize and show a collective sentiment as well, which gives greater legitimacy to your complaints, as opposed to just being a hot dog being perceived as a vandal or something. And I think there's all sorts of perfectly legitimate, quote, lawful ways to challenge companies and make progress, too. But it comes with that impulse to challenge and push back.
Well, you know, coming from the anti-war demonstrations of the 60s, when we never got a permit, we didn't ask for one, and we just filled the streets or just sat in or occupied a draft center or even a university office that was cooperating with the military. If we didn't break all those laws, I don't believe that war would have ended.
No, and, you know, Daniel Ellsberg had to put his butt on the line to show how we'd been lied to, and basically democracy had been betrayed.
And now we have Bradley Manning, so...
That's another story.
Okay, so we're talking with David Bollier, and thanks for coming on to talk to me again. David Bollier, B-O-L-L-I-E-R, co-edited this book with Silke Helfrich, and it's called The Wealth of the Commons, a fantastic book. You should all get this. The Wealth of the Commons, A World Beyond Market and State. And where can people go online to see what you do?
There's a website, wealthofthecommons.org,
mm-hmm.
And from Amazon. So I think it's a great way to introduce yourself to the topic.
Okay. Listen, thanks for taking the extra time, and good luck with this. And maybe somewhere down the line, you know, we'll be in touch again.
Thanks again, Mike. It's great to be on your show.
Okay. David Bollier. And you should check out his website. It's great. This is it's a kind of a portal to everything that has to do with activity and books written about this whole idea of it really does belong to us. I mean, that old-fashioned, people make fun of it now, that old-fashioned folk song, this land is your land, this land is my land. Are we fast enough here? Are we high-tech enough to get that song up? No? No? Okay. All right. So... no, there's no place that can do that. I should bring it in if I want it. Anyhow, this land is your land. This land is my land. You know, this Woody Guthrie song. It is. And it's all being grabbed and privatized because the corporations bribe the politicians. They bribe the president. And then that means that they can drill under your land, eminent domain. They can seize your ranch because they want to make a profit on gas or on oil or something like that. So it's up to us to get it back. I'm not so polite and hopeful that any kind of legal or political process anymore is going to make any difference. Yeah, we can sue. All right, let's put it this way, to be mature and balanced about it. We'll have to have some combination of using the political process and using the laws, class action suits and other suits like GMO, put things on ballots so that things can change. That does seem to work, and you have to keep at it because the other side will certainly be using the law and politics to do that, as they do, perverting it their own way. So we have to use that, and we want to stay within the sort of in the scope of civilization. We don't want to step right outside of it, and because then everybody will have an excuse, and the bigger guns will always win, and they have the bigger guns. But all of this legal and political activity, which I'm sure is important, has to be accompanied. We'll never succeed without masses of people, and I'm talking about hundreds of thousands or millions of people, breaking the law. And I'm not talking about murder, and I'm not talking about assault and battery. I'm talking about putting a monkey wrench in the machine so it grinds to a halt and maybe falls apart so that we can start over again and do it the right way. We're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be back. This is Occupied Territory America with Mike Fader.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting as the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land.
You feel that? I feel that. Every time I hear that song, I feel it. I feel energized. I feel inspired. I feel elevated. Monsanto owns the cornfields and the soy fields now. We're some gigantic company. Who owns the seashore? Who owns the water underneath where you're walking? Who owns that shoreline that he's singing about? All these things he's singing about, the mountains, the valleys, the rivers, the shoreline, the fields, they don't belong to anybody anymore except big companies. Eminent domain. It's out of control. It's as if the bad guys in some old Western actually won at the end of every movie. Not the good guy. It's like, you know, the evil rancher who didn't want to let the farmers have some access to his water. And then, you know, the hero comes in. This is the plot of 102,000 Westerns, right, that I watched when I was growing up. And then ultimately the hero, and even the marshal, is corrupt. They knew enough in those old movies, you know, it's not like a new thing in the world. The sheriff was corrupt, or the marshal was corrupt, and he was working for the bad guys. And in the end of these movies, what happens is that the bad sheriff and the bad, you know, rancher, or the bad owner of everything who's trying to impose his will for greed on everybody else and take away what belongs to them, or what they share in common, they are defeated. Sometimes they feel guilty, or sometimes they're unrepentant. They have to be killed, shot down, dead by the good guy. Now we live in a country, and we live in a world, but let's limit it to our country, where the bad guys at the end of these movies win. The hero gets locked up or tortured or thrown in jail. The Supreme Court declares that he has no rights. The president says it's okay to do it. And all the farmers have to sign a document that says that they will never touch the water unless they pay $100 an ounce for it. And that's the end of the movie now. Do we want to see that happen to our lives, really? And part of the problem is that where a lot of people are comfortable. I mean, some people are poor and they have nothing to lose. They want to get out there. Other people feel, and it's the way of the world, that they have a lot to lose. And people sometimes do have a lot to lose. These days, they know what you're thinking. They know what you're writing. They know where you're walking. And no joke, it's not made. It's not conspiracy theory anymore. Between the cell towers and the GPS devices, there's a new, yet another argument going on that's going to wind up in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, about 2 months ago or 3 months ago, made a decision that a law enforcement authority, because they suspect somebody of being a criminal or doing something criminal, cannot just slap a GPS locator, you know, under the hood or under the, you know, the undercarriage or somewhere, hide it in a car somewhere or a truck and follow where somebody's going every second. At least you have to get a goddamn warrant. But the government doesn't think so. The federal government is now going to re-argue that case by using another example. Of course, it's all terrorists. And this is their byword for everything and everybody. We've been through this before in this show, but you have to understand, and I'm sure a lot of you do who listen to this show, it's a selective audience, right? I'm preaching to the converted already or whatever it is, or people who didn't need to be converted. Nevertheless, you never know who's going to hear it, and you could repost these shows. The shows appear, by the way, on podcasts. So this show, Occupied Territory America, it's got a new name, though on Facebook, it's just going to be called Occupied Territory because Facebook, for some bizarre reason that I don't understand, will not allow you to change the name of, did I lose my headphones? Sometimes they just come off. No, I don't know. They just sort of disappear. They're going in and out. Facebook has issued a rule somewhere. They have a rule that if you have under, I forget what it is, over 300 or 500 likes, if 300 or 500 people have liked or continue to like your page, you cannot change the title of it. Odd, I think. Let us all remember that Facebook, let us not have the illusion that Facebook is a common thing for all of us to share everything that we want and to get great benefit from everybody else. It's a business. It's a business that makes tens of billions of dollars of profit. And as you can see, they have cooperated with corporations and the federal government to track you, to put ads on. Google, all of these places are businesses. You know, it almost looks as if because you're on the net, when you go on the net and you use Facebook or you do searches or you do whatever messaging with people, it seems as if it's just a big, happy, equal family where everybody is contacting everybody else and everybody's trading things and everybody's learning things. No, no, no. This 95% of this crap is corporate. How many times now can you, if you use Google, and I'm sure most of you who are tech savvy, which is probably more tech savvy than me, which maybe means everybody listening. Now I go online when I use Google as a search. Is it called a search engine? Is that what Google is, a search engine? Okay. Apparently, probably other people may want to use other search engines, but I use Google. It seems convenient and I'm used to it. Every time I go on there now, because of some product I bought or some corporatized website I went to, like, I don't know how this happened, but every time I go onto Google, I could go on there to see how to grow flowers, to buy a tropical fish, to learn how to get the latest news from Alternet or Common Dreams on the latest depredations of corporations and the government. And what appears right in front of my face and will not go away is a giant ad that says, "Ever been arrested?" Ever been arrested? And it has these pictures of the worst, most bizarre-looking trailer trash. Reality TV couldn't make up the people that they put in there who have been arrested, right? And, you know, it's saying, it's implying that this could be you. It says, "Ever been arrested?" No. "Well, if you have, your records are available to everyone." Well, they are now, I guess. I don't know. I mean, you know what I'm talking about right now, because this probably happens to all of you who, or most of you who do searching all the time. You go on there, something will pop up. Like I once looked into prostate medicine. I cannot go anywhere online, even if it's to figure out how to buy a sharper knife to cut vegetables in my kitchen, without seeing a giant bottle of prostate medicine. The other one has ever been arrested. I have no idea where that came from. So, I mean, it's not free. But it should be, right? There's got to be some way, really, where it should be. Am I saying that all the software engineers and all the entrepreneurs and all the people who put in millions of hours of work to develop this genius invention, the net, or, you know, search engines and all these other things. Am I saying that they shouldn't be compensated for their effort? Of course not. If you work hard and you work for the common good, that is a moral dictum, to use a very strong word, that I would put on everything and everybody. I believe that people should not do things. I shouldn't say should, because it's absurd. It's not human nature. But I believe that the best people can do, and what people should constantly do all the time, should be as much as possible for the greater good and for the common good and the common wealth of everyone. I believe that. I believe it like a religion. And that is not what is going on in this country. Things, post offices, in Chicago, to raise money in Chicago, they gave away the parking meters to a private company. Of course, now it costs four times as much to park in Chicago as it did before, right? But presumably, the city makes money. Let me tell you something. There's been a wave of studies, and cities and municipalities and some states are beginning to find out that giving away their prisons and giving away their parking meters and giving away their tolls and the maintenance of their bridges and the ownership of the, and cleanliness of their schools to private companies has not worked out. They're not getting paid very much by them. They're being, you know, like cheated, which all companies will do anytime they can get away with it. And the citizens are being treated to such gigantic rises in prices and such inferior service that, in fact, the deal wasn't worth it. And now the United States government, at the behest of some Republican, maybe even Democrat organized, connection to some huge private corporation like FedEx, or this is something you're going to find out about in a year, I predict. Remember those old astrology types, you know, in the newspapers or on TV? My prediction will be this. Next year, there will be, they used to have this in only the Weekly World News and all these crazy things, which they don't sell anymore, unfortunately. All I see is gossip about stars, nude pictures, Hillary Clinton dying of brain cancer, or her husband's dying of foot cancer, who somebody else married or who split up with who. You know, there used to be these great newspapers called the Weekly World News and the National Enquirer or whatever it was. It wasn't just gossip. It would be great headlines, like, and they would have these pictures, I guess now you call it photoshopped, of alien heads on human bodies. And it would say, there was one typical headline would be, boy of nine impregnates 12 nurses. aliens have been found in the White House. Of course, that's not, you know, probably too far-fetched. But it used to have these great things, you know, like stories like skydiver, you know, rapes housewife. Horrible, you know, cheesy crap. Of course, that's all gone to reality television now. But I miss these. I miss these things because I had a dream once of actually working for one of these places. Because you can make up bizarre headlines. You don't have to even write them, by the way. If you just make up the headlines, no matter how crazy or stupid or insane they are, you know. And it used to have things like Rosicrucians, whatever they are, or astrologers predict this for the next year. Well, you know, you can predict things, and they don't seem so bizarre anymore. That's why I always use all these cultural references, movies or books, especially movies. Popular culture, these people have their antennae out. They can feel what's happening. They can see what's happening in society. They're not stupid, but they have a kind of a shrewd understanding of the way things are and a way of synthesizing this information and putting it back out into the public to show them what they're seeing already, what they're afraid of, and what will probably happen. So when you see the Terminator, or you see Blade Runner, or you see Fifth Element, or any of these kinds of movies, which are supposed to be science fiction, they're just predicting what's going to happen. And what now has, give it 10 or 20 years, these things all happen. These things all happen. And examples of these things, T. Boone Pickens, who was an oil billionaire from Texas, you may have heard of him. That's not Slim Pickens, the actor. This is T. Boone Pickens, who is another, you know, insane greed head from Texas, oil and gas. He has bought up the water rights in millions of acres of land in several adjoining western states. He has bought up the water rights. The question is, who sold him the water rights? Who sold him the water rights? International agricultural companies and sovereign governments like Saudi Arabia and China and other huge companies have bought up tens of millions of acres of land in Africa. This land is and was now inhabited by people who live there, who have been there for thousands of years, farming and raising cattle and collecting, hunting, almost hunting and gathering, right? They live there and they've lived there forever. Now, they don't own their land anymore. The land does not belong to them to the extent that it ever did, that they ever filed a deed for it. They didn't think they had to. Then you could say, well, that's innocent. That's stupid. That's naive. It's the modern world. Wise up. Really? That's just another sorry excuse for taking things away from people. This is what happened with the Indians in this country, right? Initially, the Americans showed up, you know, the Americans, who now are called the Americans. The Europeans showed up, the Dutch and the British particularly, and then a few other of them. But basically, the Dutch and the British, they show up in this country and they look around. They see that there's no law, just savages. They're not Christians, God forbid. And so they're savages. They're not Christians. They're not white. They don't speak a civilized language. So we can do whatever we want. All of this land, this astoundingly rich land, hundreds of millions of acres of woodland teeming with beaver and other and deer and mink and millions of things, skins, furs, resources everywhere, water. And then later on, they find coal, you know, when they get into the industrial age. All of this stuff is there. All this land, essentially, in the beginning, it was farmland and it was trapping, you know, animals for fur. And then, of course, looking for gold and silver wherever they could find it. All of this stuff, they come here. There's no courts. There's no laws. You know, that they can see. Of course, there are all kinds of rituals and common understandings among all the Indian tribes, and then intra, you know, among these tribes. They see no big buildings. They see no courts. They see no laws. No judges with wigs. They don't see any sheriffs, people with badges. They don't see anything like that. So they say, these savages have no laws. They don't own anything. Show me the deed. Why should they? For millennia, these people have been born, died, born, died, born, died, and the land belongs to everyone and to no one. If it belongs to anyone, it belongs to the Great Spirit, to that eternal force of nature which created it in the first place and which maintained it all of these untold, you know, millennia. And then along come these people who, out of their greed and their ignorance and their petty-minded egocentricity and narcissism, say that that's not the law. There's been no deed filed. They just took it away from them. They took the whole goddamn country away from them. This is happening in Africa now with the connivance of corrupt local and national African governments. Between the bribes given to municipal townships and to states in Africa and then to national governments, never mind the straight-out dictatorships, big companies and sovereign nations like Saudi Arabia and China are buying, have bought, own the land where people, farmers, destitute sometimes, or just poor or simple people, in fact they are, who just farm this land, raise their cattle, gathered fruit, gathered vegetables, whatever it is, and that was enough for them. And this is the moral and economic ethic. The economics comes from the morality. The basic moral and human point here is that we all own this world in common. We own the world in common. And in fact, we don't own it at all. It does sound contradictory, but it's not, right? To the extent that anybody owns anything in this world, basically, then I'm talking about land, water, air, minerals, resources, forests. Nobody owns this stuff. And yet now there's a price on everything. There is a price on everything. Soon what you're going to see, and this is, I was talking about predictions before. I have a friend who has been predicting for a long time, this goes back 20 years now, that within 5 years, there will be a law, a national law passed that says, you know, everybody will be on record. You'll have a barcode printed across your, you know, tattooed on your head. Nobody in the future, within 5 years in the future, 10 years maybe, there will be barcodes tattooed on you by force by the government. If you don't, they'll throw you in jail. They'll lock you up and they'll do it by force. Otherwise, people have to go voluntarily, and they'll go probably too, because they'll get a free microwave or a flat screen TV. This is how lazy and stupid and unaware people have become in this country. There will be barcodes tattooed onto your skin or imprinted or chips put into people, and they will be scanned everywhere. Wherever you go, every five blocks, you will have to hold your hand up to a street scanner. Or wherever you go into a store, any place you go, they will know where you are. They know who you are. They will know because of Facebook and Google and the Bureau of Motor Vehicles and the IRS. They will know exactly how much you earned, how much money you have available. And here's what my friend is predicting. And this is for the future. He's predicting that within 10 years that there will be a federal law passed. And if you violate, if you break this law, it'll be punishable by 5 years in jail or a fine of $100,000 or whatever. That you must buy a certain amount. There'll be a minimum amount of consumer goods, resources, and produced goods that you will have to buy in a year or you will go to jail. In other words, it won't be that they're going to track ads or that they will intrude on your private space to try to sell you something. They won't have monopolies that keep raising the prices. This is basically a way of centralizing all corporate global power. What will happen is that every year or every 6 months maybe, they will check your bank account automatically, and there's nothing you can do about it. And they'll check your credit card account. They will see how much money you spent based on your income and based on your expenses. If you didn't spend a certain portion of your income on luxuries or something that is not a necessity, if you didn't spend anything on that, if you didn't spend enough money on a car, on gas, on television, on oil, on a certain kind of food, on drugs or on doctors or on, whatever it is, especially on pharmaceuticals, medications that are prescribed for you. If you didn't spend enough money on that, they will put you in jail and they will make you work or pay a fine so that, this is what's going to happen. You are nothing now but a consumer. You are a unit. They own everything, but they don't have the right to any of this. They don't have the right to any of this. My view of things is, and this is a deeply detailed thing, but abstractly and simply put it this way, no one has the right to own practically anything. You should have the right to sort of go anywhere and do anything within the bounds of common good and civilization. You don't intrude on somebody's common privacy. You don't invade their space. You don't take what belongs to them just because you feel like it or you want to have more. Enough is enough. You don't need to have more than enough. There's an old saying from the 19th century, probably some Christian saying that says, enough is as good as a feast. Also used in a movie, by the way. What was it called? I forget now. It's called Enough is as good as a feast. Yes. This whole concept in the United States of gross domestic product, of growth. You ever see in the newspapers or in speeches, political speeches, we only had 2% growth last year. The economic growth of the country has slowed down. You know what? We don't need to grow anything. Enough is enough. All we have to do is produce enough to feed people, to provide simple resources and necessities, housing, clothing, shelter, and not much more. But America is based on getting more and more and more and taking what belongs to other people. It's an astounding thing. It's an astounding thing. It's based on a complete lack of morality or an immorality. And the concept is enough is enough. So this whole idea of the country's economy expanding only by 2% last year or 1.1% and how that's such a disaster. Did you ever stop to ask yourself when you read that, what does it mean, first of all? And secondly, why does it have to expand? It doesn't have to expand. You know what expands constantly without control? Cancer. Cancer. The economic expansion of the United States, the accumulation of more and more things by individuals and by huge corporations, and the accumulation and ultimately of our lives, we're going to run out of food. We are going to run out of food. And guess what the next food is going to be when they run out of the rest of the food? You. You, they're going to break you down and chop you up and package you. And believe me, somebody is going to file for the ownership of, maybe block by block. People like Mayor Bloomberg, the mayors of different cities, the heads of the governors of the state and the president of Congress will issue laws saying that they're going to set up boards and determine. This sounds like right wing lunacy, right? But it's all the same after a while. They'll determine how useful you are as against how much food is needed by other people in the country. That's what's going to happen. All of this stuff that I'm saying, if somebody said this stuff 20 years ago or something like this, people would say, oh, that's crazy. That's a right-wing conspiracy. That's a left-wing conspiracy. And then it turns out that it's reality. Privatization is happening. They're selling the post offices. They're selling water from right under your feet. They're selling your water away to somebody who lives three states away and has billions of dollars and wants the water to frack for gas. They're selling, giving away rights to build things in subways, in public parks. Even if it's a pay deal, like I'm used to watching sports on TV. Now I'm watching a hockey game the other night. It's not enough they have some crap running along the bottom or there's an ad every second. Then they put ads on the game while they're playing it. Soon, the game itself will be played on a strip underneath the ad. This is how it is. And the latest cultural reference, what is that movie with, where people come in the future, they listen to channels where it's all commercials. They don't even know the difference between commercials and I forget the name of this movie now. They're so crazy and so sodden with consumer culture. They only listen to commercials and they love them. They don't even understand art or music anymore. So watch out. It's up to us to take it back. That's it for this week.